Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from 970 ESPN and Steelers Nation Radio, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves chilling, talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave, Season 7, Episode 121. I'm Dave Bryan from SteelersDepot.com and sitting in once again for David Todd, who I believe is traveling to New York City today, is Alex Cazora. Alex, happy Monday, and man, officially welcome to the one of the deadest period of the offseason.
We were talking, as we usually do, Dave, before the show to figure out exactly what we wanted to talk about. Didn't come up with a lot. So, Dave, can you juggle? Can you tell some jokes? I don't know. We might need to really go down the rabbit hole today.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be that entertaining overall as far as that. That, but, you know, we always seem, you know, it's not like this is a new part of what we go through off season, and we always end up finding things to talk about, you know, and hopefully that won't include us having to continually rehash the contract situations with Le'Veon Bell and Alejandro Villanueva and Stephon Tuitt and those kind of things. You know, we obviously will be talking about those a little bit more, you know, over the course of the next several weeks, but we'll try to give people a little bit of a break from that today. And, you know, obviously not a lot happened over the weekend as far as the Steelers are concerned. They obviously wrapped up their mandatory mini camp this past week, and now they're going to be off, believe it or not, 38 days from today, Alex, is when they report to training camp. And that seems like quite a long time away as we sit here right now. But I wanted to start things off today. And by the way, for those listening, I will be back in Florida on Friday through Tuesday. So there'll be no podcast this coming Friday, no podcast on Monday, but we will resume a week from Friday on that. I think Alex may or may not, we'll leave it up to him to decide whether or not he wants to put any of his videos up on, you know, breakdowns or anything, you know, along those lines up on the site. So, you know, kind of keep in tune with what's happening on Steelers Depot as well. But I want to start off today, and when I wrote this kind of over the weekend, I kind of thought it would have been received a little bit better than what it was, Alex. And the feedback that I got, especially on Twitter, is, you know, why the hell are you writing about this in so many words? But look, I mean, Vegas puts out odds on this kind of stuff early, and yes, we haven't seen the rookies play any. You know, all we have to go on is OTA and mini camp practice reports, and even those are kind of, you know, limited on what we get there. But what I wrote about was, you know, whether or not TJ Watt should be considered a legitimate rookie, you know, of defensive rookie of the year candidate. And the initial pushback, I guess people just read the headline on Twitter, said, well, we haven't even seen him play, you know, it's too early for this. But, you know, this part of the offseason, when you're looking for kind of things to talk about, discuss, I thought it was kind of relevant. And like it or not, we're going to talk about it today. And I think for starters, if you go back and you look all the way back to the 2007 season, to find a player, a defensive rookie, who wasn't drafted in the first round, you know, you have to go back that far. D'Amico Ryans was actually the last player not drafted in the first round to win Defensive Rookie of the Year. So, you know, logic tells you that it will be, you know, a first-round player this year. And, man, there's some great candidates, obviously. You have your edge rushers in – Well, Myles Garrett, obviously, and then you have defensive lineman Solomon Thomas, which will be interesting to see how the San Francisco 49ers utilize him. You have, Philadelphia Eagles defensive end Derek Barnett. Of course, he had a multitude of sacks in college at Tennessee. And then, you have the off-the-ball linebackers in Hassan Reddick and Jared Davis and Reuben Foster. And while in order for an off the ball linebacker, generally, one would think in order to win the award, look, we've seen Luke Kuechly and several others, what was it, four or five, I think, over the course of the last decade have actually won that award. One would think that they're going to have to register quite a few, I mean, well over 100 total tackles in order for something like that to happen, because they obviously don't get the sack numbers, that the edge rushers and the defensive linemen need to have. And then, of course, last year we saw Joey Bosa easily, in my opinion, win Defensive Rookie of the Year award, even though he played in 12 games. And what's pretty astonishing about what he was able to accomplish is that he registered 10.5 sacks in just 561 total defensive snaps played. And I guess, what I'm getting at here is, yes, T.J. Watt, no way, shape, or form should be considered, a favorite or even, maybe even the second tier type of guys, because obviously you have the defensive backs, rookie defensive backs involved in that. But I think, history has told us that you better have a lot of interceptions, a la Marcus Peters, what he did a few years ago. But in short, what do you think about, the chances of a guy like T.J. Watt potentially hitting, I mean, let's face it, he'll need 8, 9, 10 or more sacks, one would think, to win the award. Mm-hmm. What kind of chances does he have to do, to do that?
Right. That's what I was going to counter with, is I think those odds are pretty slim, because you look at the list for rookie of the years who were primary pass rushers, usually year round, double digit sacks, whether that's Bosa with 10.5, Aaron Donald with 9, Von Miller with 11.5, Sue with 10. You see the pattern here. And I said before, I think on the last podcast, that I think Watt's successful season would be 5 sacks and, twice as many pressures, 10 or so pressures maybe the whole year. So because he's going to be in that rotation, and because some of these other rookies are on the league, likely or not to be, they're going to play the full complement of snaps or pretty close to it. That's going to put Watt at a disadvantage. So I like Reddick to be a favorite, though. He's going to be a guy that's going to get some sacks out on the edge when the Cardinals put him there, and he's going to be someone that's obviously going to rack up a bunch of tackles as well. So I think he's going to stuff the stat sheet better than anybody else, any other rookie. And he's my personal favorite.
And obviously with Watt, it's going to come down to, the percentage of snaps that he can get on the field. Soon one would, and we've talked about this a few times. We expect him on the field right away, right? But we just, the percentage of snaps that he's probably going to have to split with, James Harrison, obviously, for starters, and who knows about a guy like Anthony Ciccolo, who has worked on that right side as well throughout the offseason practices. What's realistic in, say, the first quarter of the season for, a percentage amount of snaps for Watt? Because that will obviously, we expect him, I would think, to slowly pick up, more and more snaps, in place of James Harrison as the season wears on. But the first quarter to maybe even 6 games, one would think it's going to be limited. What kind of percentage can you see him playing in, say, that first quarter of the season to first 6 games?
I still think it's going to be a pretty, relatively high amount, maybe 40%. And by the end of the year, he averages 50%. Just based on what we know so far, about his football IQ and the praise that he's getting. And I think the big thing for him, which we already knew, and, Keith Butler and others have talked about, is that playing in that Wisconsin defense where he played with his hand up, he played in a 3-4, he knows about stunts, he knows how to be the contained guy, the looper, dropping into coverage, regarding the tight end, and just his actual tape that shows he's a much more advanced guy than you'd expect for someone with a 1-year starting experience at the position. I think it's going to really accelerate and lessen his learning curve. So, I think the first quarter of the year, he might play 40% of the snaps, and they ease him, give him another 10% the rest of the way. So I don't think it's going to be a real slow burn where he's going to play super limited amount the first quarter. I think they're going to throw him into the fire.
If him being as far along advanced as he is, according to these reports during the offseason practices, I mean, what's the drawback to even playing him 50-50 with Harrison early on?
I really don't think there is one, you know, as we stand today. Obviously, you know, those specifics aren't going to be known until we get into camp and in the games and see how this guy does when pads come on. For all we know, he'll do fantastic, and maybe that needs more snaps, or maybe he'll struggle and you decide to roll things back a bit. But you know, like I said, I don't think he's going to be super eased into this thing. I think that they recognize the pass rush has to get better at the outside linebacker position. They You know, I've said again, time and time again, that they want to get home with four. He's a first-round guy. He's an accomplished guy. I think they like his IQ and his work ethic. He's going to be in shape. We know that. That's not going to be, I think, a major issue for him. A lot of rookies struggle with. So I think he's going to hit the ground running.
When you look at the first, by the time the bye week rolls around, which is right in the middle of the season this year, if he has, let's say, three or four sacks, and you know, obviously, I'll have to go back and look. I don't think the voters judge quality of sacks. In this, I mean, we've seen some guys obviously get some gimmies and all, and some stats patterns, if you will. But let's say a guy like Watt can get three or four, regardless of the quality of them, by the time the bye week rolls around. I mean, does his chances of potentially hitting, obviously it does. I mean, increase of him hitting 8, 9, 10 sacks in his rookie season?
Yeah, if he can do that. But again, I think it's just tough for some of these rookie edge guys, you know, in Pittsburgh when you're not playing the whole time. I think Bosa, whenever he was out there, played the majority of the time. I don't have the exact number on that, but I imagine he did. Watt's not going to have that, you know, opportunity because it's going to be split with James Harrison. So, sure, if he can get, you know, four sacks by the bye, that's huge. I'm not expecting it, but that would obviously increase his chances the rest of the way.
What's the biggest fear with him right now by putting him in early? Play against the run?
I think just the general, you know, the details, the real nitty-gritty of where to line up, how to adjust with different shifts and motions, and, you know, playing against more 12 and 13 personnel. Now, he probably saw that more than most linebackers do, playing, against, like, Iowas of the world and teams like that. But I don't know if it's specific run or pass. I think it's going to be just the details of adjusting yourself. And then maybe it's just some frustration of not being the dominant guy. Because he's going to have his struggles like any rookie's going to. Artie Burns had it last year. You know, in college, you're the king. You know, Watt made it look easy. He starts a year, becomes a first-round pick, has a really strong season in Wisconsin. It's not going to be the case in the NFL. The success is not going to be immediate, and I think there's a mental element that any rookie has to deal with of going from, you know, big guy on campus to just another guy and how you handle that transition. That's tough.
Where would you let me do this. Someone in my post posted, you know, and I haven't seen these from, I think it's probably from one of the offshore sports books, for the odds for Defensive Rookie of the Year. They have, and it wasn't, I don't know which site this was, but TJ Watt listed at 12-1 odds to win Rookie of the Year, which is, according to this list, fifth best, believe it or not. Miles Garrett at 7-2. Lattimore, would you believe Lattimore? 8-1 odds, according to this one sports book. Jamal Adams, a safety, 8-1 odds. Takaris McKinley from the Falcons, next, 9-1 odds. And then TJ Watt, 12-1. He is tied with Malik Hooker of the Colts of 12-1. Reuben Foster, 14-1. And then Jonathan Allen, 16-1. Are those, I mean, I kind of expected the odds to be a little bit longer on Watt, right, than 12-1?
You're the more the betting man than I am, but that does sound a little optimistic for the odds. I think Adams and Hooker have great chances. They're going to be probably day one starters, and the Jets defense is going to be on the field a lot this year, so Adams is going to have a chance to break up some tackles, and Hooker is that center field free safety that's going to get some interceptions. Dave, let me ask you this, because I've talked about my projection with Watt a lot. I said 5 sacks would be a really good year for him. What do you think? Where do you think he realistically comes in at by the end of the season?
I don't know. I mean, I was accused in this post of going full Homer here.
Well, when aren't you accused of that, Dave?
I think he can best five. I'm expecting him to
Okay.
best five, to be honest with
You're
you.
really you're expecting it. I mean,
Yeah.
Dupree did what, four and a half his rookie year?
Yeah, but I think Watt's a little bit, even though you're a 1 year starter, you all the talk about those heavy hands and I compiled all of his sacks at Wisconsin. Even though overall looking at those, you'd say, man, how impressive were those overall? Not as impressive obviously as guys like Garrett and Barrett. Who was the kid that we liked out of Kansas State?
Jordan Willis.
Yeah, Jordan Willis, but I mean, there's obviously a lot to work with, I think, with Watt. I'll be disappointed, very disappointed if it's not over five, to be quite honest with you.
Really?
I just think that they're going to try to get him on the field, in more of the primary. Being the lion's share guy of snaps over Harrison sooner rather than later, and I like his chances of getting say 3 sacks. I mean, let's face it. I mean, it doesn't matter when or how you get these things. Hopefully, the Steelers can be in a couple of these blowouts early on. I mean, the first half of their schedules I think's easier than their second half. So I think
For sure.
the odds of maybe, getting some of those, up by 10, third and nine, kind of when you have the offense in situations that they, don't, predictable kind of situations there. I'm going to be disappointed if he doesn't have 6, 7 sacks, to be honest with you, Alex. Now here's the thing, Jonathan Allen listed at 16-1. I might be willing to jump on those odds, right? I mean,
I'm not crazy about Allen, playing in Washington's 3-4. You're not going to get a ton of numbers there, and the shoulder kind of makes me nervous. I'd probably take one of the safeties. I want to clarify something real quick. What we talked about with Harrison getting, walking the lion's share over Harrison, I wasn't clear, or over, yeah, over Harrison, what were you referring to?
I think by middle of the season, Watt will begin to get the lion's share of the snaps.
So like a 70-30 split? What does that mean?
I don't know, 65, 35. I mean, let's. I mean,
Wow.
tip your hat to. And I'm not trying to take anything away from James Harrison, but Father Time's undefeated. And I know he
Right.
works harder than any other person. That you'll find and all, but at some point, I mean, this is going to catch up with him.
Yeah, we say that every year. I mean, I know it will, but it always seems to be the next year. I don't know. I don't think the split's going to get that heavy. I think Harrison's going to, he's still been the best pass rusher. I don't know if the drop off is going to be so much, or Watt's going to play so well to really limit Harrison. Like, I think it's going to be in every series rotation, like they have done for what, the last 2 years now, where Harrison will play the first series, Watt plays the second, and they just rotate like that for most of the game.
Now, when we get through the first half of the season, first 8 games, into the bye, I expect it to be something like, I don't know, four. I think 40-60 is fair, right? For Watt,
40.
40%.
I think Watt on a per game basis is going to be playing between 40 and 50% of the defensive snaps.
And I think during the second half of the season, I think you could see a flip of that. So, obviously that works out to about a 50%. I wouldn't be surprised at the end of the season if Watt is more around 55%.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get too bogged down the minutia of it, but I mean, if there is any sort of favor for Watt, it's going to be slim. I don't know if 65-35 or anything around there is gonna happen. I think it's just tough for me to envision.
All right. And look, you're talking about in these odds here with Lattimore and Adams, and I can understand more of an argument for a cornerback, I think, than I can a safety, because boy, the last time, and I pointed this out in my article, the last time a safety won the Defensive Player of the Year award was, geez, when was it? 90,
1990.
nine, was it 99 or something? I have it in this article somewhere here, but just odds are against. I mean, safety obviously going to have a lot of Mark Carrier, 1990. I mean, that's. I mean, of course, every year's different. When it comes to this award, you can't really base a lot of stuff on history. But anyway, we bored people probably enough with this topic now. But to wrap it up in a bow, I don't think Watt should be totally ignored.
Yeah, that's fair.
All
I think
right,
it's a good point.
Matthew had an interesting article this past week on it was related to a Pro Football Focus stat about Steelers dropping their edge rushers, and you of course have tracked that stat, with the charting over the years. Anything to kind of add on to what Matthew wrote?
I guess I don't have a whole lot to add on to it, but PFF has the graphic that the Steelers dropped their defensive linemen and edge guys more than any other team. They combined, according to this stat, they dropped them about 14.2% of the time, which was the most in the league. Obviously, when you're playing 3-4, you're gonna have a higher number there than most. The Patriots are second. The 49ers are third on this list. But I think that there's a lot of talk, because it's the off season, and this is just how talk goes, of the Steelers should switch to a 4-3. And people will lay out their reasons, and I can understand it to a small degree, but I think the biggest advantage you have with a 3-4 over a 4-3 is just that coverage flexibility, is where you don't know, if you're going to rush four, who's that fourth guy going to be, and it gives you the flexibility to drop that guy that you're not rushing and put him wherever you need him to. With a 4-3, I think you're more static because of just playing with your hand down, the body type you typically look for, as opposed to a 3-4. So I know, people say that some of these guys drop too much, and at points last year I agreed with that. I think Harrison overall probably dropped in the coverage too often last year, about a third of the time. But I think when you play the 3-4, you get that flexibility, and oftentimes, just in that scheme, if you're going to rush four out of your base 3-4, someone's going to drop into coverage.
Do you think that number stays that percentage, that 85.8% stays the same in 2017? Goes up, down?
About the same. I don't have a great compelling reason to say either way. I think individually the numbers might change a little bit. I kind of hope Harrison, does rush a little more often. I think he's still a decent guy that can drop into coverage. I posted the one clip yesterday on Twitter about him dropping against the Colts and rerouting the number two receiver inside. But yeah, I think his percentage was on the high side last year.
And obviously TJ, and one of the things that we really didn't hit on in the fact of one of the things that plays against TJ Watt and his possibilities of hitting double digit sacks or even 7, 8, 9 is the fact that, let's say, if he does play 50-55% of the snaps, defensive snaps, obviously a percentage of those are going to be against the run, and the other percentage that are going to be against the pass, what kind of percentage of those are going to include him dropping into coverage and not even having a chance to rush the opposing quarterback?
Right, you're right. That's a very good point. And the last thing I would say about this is, obviously, the Steelers, especially last year, and Keith Butler talked about it, is they blitzed quite a bit, at least the second half of the year. It would be not as much the first half, but anytime that you're blitzing and you're sending the nickel corner or the safety or an inside linebacker, someone else, an edge guy, most likely is going to drop into coverage. So it's no surprise to see the Steelers at the top of the list, because when they blitz, there's almost always an edge guy that's dropping.
Yeah, what was a lot of the initial pushback on this. Need a new defensive coordinator. I mean, I'm reading some of these comments in here. Butler has the same playbook as LeBeau, you know, those kind of things. But, I mean, you're right in the fact that, you know, you just can't line up your front four and send them every time, you know, when you're in a nickel.
Right, yeah, your nickel, you know, you're going to be a little more vanilla than your base. Of course, you're playing nickel 70% of the time, but yeah, you want to be varied. The point of the 3-4, the point of having these guys stand up on the edge is to be varied with how they rush and when they rush. And if you're static, then you're predictable, and then you're going to struggle.
All right, kind of talking about rushing the quarterback and sacks and everything that goes along with that. On Sunday, I wrote about a study that Derek Clausen did on setting the edge or setting edge. I always want to say setting the edge, but it's settingedge.com. Pretty in-depth study, I thought. You know, obviously the results. I don't think he put enough emphasis. I think he came to the conclusion of what everybody kind of thought, that sacks during a drive are very important. I thought he could maybe have dug a little bit deeper into it. But when you look at offensively for the Steelers, and what we're talking about here is after a offense suffers a sack, how are they able to rebound from that and extend the drive? In other words, get a new first down or touchdown, you know, after suffering the sack. And when you look at offensively, league-wide, the average for an offense after suffering a sack being able to convert or extend the drive after that was 16.01%. The Steelers came in at 14%. Their offense came in at 14.29%, and the raw numbers of that were basically they were only sacked 21 times during the regular season last year. Essentially, only three times after they suffered a sack was the offense able to, you know, extend a drive. And I mean, is that, I mean, slightly below the league average, but I mean, is that anything to be concerned about? Were you expecting that 14.29 percentage to be a little bit higher?
Maybe a little bit, just because of the potency of the offense. But you also understand last year that, you know, they were hamstrung with the loss of several weapons. So I hope that number is better this year, and I expect it to, with, you know, Martavis Bryant back and Jesse James taking another step. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the slot. You know, there'll be a talented player there, whether that's Eli Rogers taking the next step or Juju Smith-Schuster, who beats him out. So I think the number should be higher, but it's a good study. And I think the thing that I take away from it the most is just, again, to go back to the point about pressure versus sacks. And while pressure is nice and it's useful and they're always good to have, you want to be able to finish plays with a sack. And because of the psychological factor that it brings, but also, you know, things like this, actual yardage that can translate into, you know, decrease the ability for the offense to convert. So yeah, that was an issue for the Steelers last year. So, you know, Stephon Tuitt comes to mind, a guy that missed probably three or four sacks last year. It's tough, I understand. You know, quarterbacks get paid to make plays too. You can't always finish, but you know, that's something I want to look for the Steelers defense to do, is finish some of those plays.
Yeah, and you know, look, even the Oakland Raiders and their offense, and you know, I think sample size here, probably not large enough, but obviously you're just going by what happened by one season here. If you look at the Oakland Raiders and their offense last year, they only converted 5.56% after sacks. Wow. But the thing is they were only sacked 18 times.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they only converted one time after that. So, you know, I don't think we can read deep into that number and say, man, Derek Carr just has a problem of being able to convert after sacks, because that offense was only, and obviously he wasn't on the field. When did he get injured?
Week 16, maybe.
Was it
It
week
was
six?
late in the year.
Okay, so it was late in the year, so probably most of them were on him. But
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, you look at those raw numbers and you see, well, he was only able to convert, or the Raiders were only able to convert one, after 18 sacks. Most of my writing and focus ended up being on the defensive side of the ball, and where, the effectiveness of the Steelers' defense being able to, prevent conversions after registering a sack. And defensively, they allowed a conversion rate of 21.05% after their 38 sacks. And I think even the author was a little bit kind of miffed, about why that conversion rate was so high. But after what I did is I went through and I dug through, all of the all what happened after the sacks and the conversions and all like that. And I think when you go and you look at the play by play, and obviously there were 8 times in total that following a sack that the Steelers allowed the drive to be extended, their defense did. Three of those were a result of penalties, two on Lawrence or two on Artie Burns and one on Lawrence Timmons. And then the strange fact, I think the strangest thing was four of the times that this happened, it came in games against the Browns. So, I don't know how, it was interesting to read and then dig deeper into, but I'm not so much, I guess what I'm getting at is, how does this stat hold water? I mean,
Well, I think it kind of just confirms what we thought about the importance of sacks, like I said, versus pressure. I don't know if it tells us a ton, but I think it's a good way to at least put a tangible number on it. Dave, let me ask you this. Do you have the list pulled up right now? Because I don't. Of all the teams, do you have that list?
yes, I do.
Okay, what was Cleveland's offense? What was their conversion after sacks percentage?
Let's see. Cleveland offense 21.21%, very high. One of the
Yeah.
eight teams that were more than 5% over average.
Okay, I'm just curious, and I'm not looking at the numbers, but if there's any correlation between teams that are sacked the most, like Cleveland was, I think they were number one in the league, versus their percentage, because the sample size, like you said earlier, might be a factor here, where Oakland and Pittsburgh 18 to 21 times, where Cleveland is 50 plus. Does the fact that they just get sacked so much increase their odds by nature, versus a team that's smaller? I don't know if that's playing a factor in these findings.
And that's a great point, because if you look at the eight teams with the conversion rate 5% more over league average, Arizona was sacked 41 times, Atlanta was sacked 37 times, Buffalo sacked 46 times, Cleveland, of course, 66 times they were sacked. So that's a lot of opportunities. Denver sacked 40 times, Detroit sacked 37 times, New England. Here's the outlier, and it's probably not surprising. New England only sacked 24 times, yet they converted 25% of the time. And then Philadelphia sacked 33 times. Those were the eight
Yeah.
teams there. So, that's a good point there. I came away thinking, yeah, that was great read during the offseason and all, but I'm not sure where the value is. Look, we all know sacks are important, right? And the thing that I came away from the Steelers' offense and their below average number was the fact that they were only sacked 21 times. And I think you, I, and all of the listeners can if that number 21 stayed the same in 2017, we'd probably be fine with that. We'd sign up for it right now, right?
Yep, write it down in pen if I can get that.
And here's what it made me do, is it said, well, how can I kind of take this thing a little bit further here? What I plan on doing, it's going to take some undertaking, is to go through Ben Roethlisberger's career numbers in drives following sacks. And Lord knows he's been sacked a ton
Yeah, you're gonna
during
have fun those first couple of years,
during.
Dave.
Where would you saying that the league average was, what was it, six, right at 16% for last season for offenses being able to convert after suffering a sack, where would you guesstimate? And I have no idea what this number is, but what would you guess the outcome, the percentage will be for Roethlisberger conversion rate after sacks when I get all these career numbers of his done?
Oh, man, I have no idea. 20% maybe? Throw a number out at you.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and we're just throwing darts here because, I mean, we have
– Yeah, total guess.
We have no idea whatsoever. So would that be an interesting study?
Yeah, I mean, well, people listening, let us know what you think, if that's something you'd be interested to hear about, because that's a lot of work, Dave. I don't want it to go unnoticed, but I'd be interested in it, sure.
Yeah,
I'm curious to see just how it improves over time. I assume that it is. I hope that it is, and see that progression from, rookie year Ben and early year Ben to present day Ben.
It's probably going to end up being one of those posts where I spend 8 hours on it and it gets 2 comments.
It's just one guy. It's like, I got you, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. All right, kind of moving on. During the offseason here, Alex, I'm going to be doing and have been doing some Twitter polls, Steeler-related Twitter polls to kind of find out, take the temperature of people out there. And I had 4 such polls last week, and I want to go over them and see how surprised you were with the results. All 4 of these, the goal of these things is to get roughly about 1,000 votes. I'm doing them in 24-hour periods because that's about the time it takes to get 1,000 votes on these. The first one that I asked was who will be the team's starting slot cornerback in week 1? And that ended up getting almost 1,500 total votes. And the majority, I listed 4 players there, Cinquez Goldson, Cameron Sutton, William Gay, and Cody Sensabaugh. William Gay, the majority winner, 51%. Coming in second was Cameron Sutton at 25%, Cinquez Goldson 16%, and Cody Sensabaugh 8%. Did any of these, did the rankings, did the total rankings surprise you? And what about the percentages?
No, nothing really surprised me there. I figured Gay would be the leader. He is running first team slot corner right now. He'd be my choice as we stand here today in June. That could still, of course, change. But no, I pretty much agree with the Twitter response.
All right. Are you surprised the 51% for Gay wasn't a little bit higher?
No, just when you have 4 options. And, there's a lot of people that are down on Gay and think it's time to move on. So, I can understand people thinking about other possibilities. And I still don't, know what's going on with Sensabaugh right now. I still don't entirely know what the plan is for him in Pittsburgh. I imagine he's going to be a Swiss Army guy, like I said, I think, on Friday's podcast, where he's going to play, be a backup on the outside and the slot. So that presumes he's going to get some work in the slot at some point. I don't know if it's happened yet. I don't believe it's happened yet. But, you're thinking, can he get some reps there?
All right. The second poll that I ran was related to which rookie, undrafted rookie, are Twitter followers most excited to see play in 2017. Probably not a huge surprise, but the way this one turned out, the 4 choices were Matt Golombo, Scott Orndorff, Ethan Cooper, and Fazan Odom. I expected Odom to win, I think going into this, but I was surprised that Ethan Cooper finished second with 14%. Is this more of a result of just wanting to see the offensive players, most notably Odom, and then, of course, a Pitt product like Orndorff? And is it somewhat related to maybe a lot of people just don't know who Ethan Cooper is and what, the position that he plays?
Yeah, I think it's just, Odom's the 6'8 tight end that has a highlight reel with some pretty crazy catches. And we've hyped him up a lot on Steelers Depot as well. So, maybe that's, us influencing the voters with all the talk we've had about Odom and less on Cooper. So, it's not a surprise to see Odom be that guy. I think Cooper's going to have a strong camp. And, I think he's going to be, I've said it before, strong practice squad material. And as a nice segue here, if everything goes according to plan, I'll be interviewing Ethan Cooper on Wednesday and have a nice feature story on him sometime later that week. So stay tuned for that.
All right, fantastic. The third poll that I ran, predict the statuses of free agent additions, running back Nile Davis and Justin Hunter. I gave them 4 options. Both make the roster, neither make the roster. Only Nile makes the roster, only Justin Hunter makes the roster, and the winner, 52% of the vote of 928 votes, the Twitter followers said only Nile Davis makes the roster. 25% came in second, would both make the roster. Anything surprising there?
I think the Twitter users got this one right. I think the two most likely options are only Nile makes it and both making it. And, you know, I keep going back to that, you know, Colbert stat that you've posted before about when they sign free agents, they almost always make the roster. Now, Hunter's in a weird situation because I don't think he was really signed because the team was so gung-ho about him that he fills a need. It was almost an insurance policy on Martavis Bryant because they just didn't know and still to a degree don't know what's going to end up happening with Martavis Bryant. So obviously that wide receiver room is so crowded right now. I think Hunter's going to have a good camp. He's going to make some plays. You know, a 6'4 guy that's an athlete that can go win 50-50 balls. He's going to look good. I just don't think there's going to be a home for him. So I voted on this one, actually, and I voted for only now Davis makes the roster.
You know, the thing with Hunter, I wrote about this past week as well, too. He really should closely examine what Darius Hayward Bay is, Darius Hayward Bay, after he was released by the Oakland Raiders, everybody should know the story by now. He went to the Indianapolis Colts for the first over half of the season. He was used offensively, and then towards the later end of the season, he was ultimately became a kind of an afterthought offensively, and he had to jump in special teams, I think, with only like three games remaining, right around there. And this is a guy in Darius Hayward Bay that admittedly himself never played special teams at Maryland in college, never played special teams in high school. Now, I don't know whether or not he returned a punt or two or kickoff, but I'm talking about covering kicks, covering punts and all like that. And, as we know by now, he turned in to be a pretty damn good, special teams player. He doesn't offer much more than that other than you go deep, kind of scenarios. But in essence, Justin Hunter's career path has gone the same direction. And assuming a guy like Martavis Bryant stays healthy and out of trouble, and assuming the rest of the roster stays healthy, and this includes Sammy Coates, it's going to now. I mean, Justin Hunter is going to have to show that he can play special teams, right?
Yeah, I mean, the more you can do, I mean, if you're fighting for that last spot, you have to show something there. So that's a great point that you made, Dave, about how their career is kind of, where DHB was at one point is similar to where Hunter is at now. You got to show something different because there's a lot of Z receivers on this team that are height, weight, speed guys. That's not making Hunter particularly unique on this roster. So you got to do something to be unique.
The thing, when you go back, though, and I posted this when I researched this stat on Twitter, or posted on Twitter after researching it, was the fact that, and you can cherry pick Pro Football Reference, as much as you want to kind of get maybe some results that you want to do, but I think that one of the things that was probably not overly surprised about Justin Hunter is going back to his draft year, which was what, 2013, am I right? With Hunter, from 2013 on, of all wide receivers in the NFL with 75 or more receptions, Justin Hunter, I think, ranked sixth overall in average yards per reception. So, he can stretch the field for sure. He can make the big play for you. But outside of that, I mean, he doesn't, and without, it goes without saying that Martavis Bryant was, what was he, third, fourth on that list, something like that, as well. So, I mean, you hit on it just, a little while ago, saying that, Justin Hunter, and I pretty much wrote about this right after the signing happened. You got to really look at Justin Hunter's insurance for Martavis Bryant.
Right. Now, the one thing Hunter does have, I don't want to forget about, is he played in the slot quite a bit in Buffalo last year. He might not be, and he isn't, that conventional slot-looking guy, but a guy that can move around if somebody goes down, or just a chance to get more reps. Because, like I said, the Z spot's going to be so crowded with other guys, getting time there. Bryant needing his reps, and Sammy Coates proving himself that if Hunter can get some extra work inside, more power to him.
All right, in my final poll of the week, that wrapped up on Saturday, I asked Twitter followers, of the four fringe players listed below, which one has the best chance at ultimately making the final 53-man roster? The choices were Damian Stafford, LJ Fort, DeMarcus Ayers, Johnny Maxey. I had a feeling that DeMarcus Ayers was going to be the choice. However, I was a bit surprised that people, that 30% of the 948 votes went to LJ Fort at second, and only 19% of the votes went for Damian Stafford make it. I kind of thought Damian Stafford would have gave DeMarcus Ayers a little bit better run for his money.
You know what the biggest problem with this poll is, Dave?
What's that?
It's the use of emojis you have here. Four of them, Dave. What are you doing? You trying to be like the cool kids? Be yourself.
I'm trying to be a millennial. I'm trying to use more emojis. No, in all serious, are you surprised that a guy like LJ Fort garnered 30% of the votes?
Yeah, maybe a little bit, because I don't think Fort really gets talked about too much. I think, you know, if you ask what team does LJ Fort play for to any random Steelers fan on the street, half of them might not know he's a Steeler. It's an interesting discussion, though. You know, I mean, you think about backup Mac linebacker. Fort's more athletic than Matakevich or Steven Johnson. And, you know, could that be the end that Fort needs to stick on this roster? I don't know. I think it's an interesting point. I think it's a good eye or a good click by the Twitter users. I'd probably put Ayers first and Stafford in second place, but you can make a case for any of those three guys, I think.
All right. Now probably what's going to end up being the best part of this show, Twitter user questions, listener questions. Unless you got anything else to wrap up with topics that you want to cover before we get to this, Alex?
I just did want to mention real quick, you know, we've talked about, Richard Mann's final season and who's going to replace him. And I think the only answer I've ever seen from Steeler fans is Hines Ward, which I don't expect to happen for many reasons. So I wanted to throw out just at least one other name, and it's early, you know, who knows what's going to happen. Mann might not even retire after this year, but Bob Gronkowski, who was fired from the Titans this past year as their wide receivers coach, who actually, in my research of him, was the Steelers wide receiver coach in, I think, 1999 and 2000. And it was down to him and Mike Mularkey to be the Steelers' next offensive coordinator, and Coward chose Mularkey. And so Dick LeBeau got Gronkowski and made him the OC in Cincinnati for, I think, 9 or 10 years. And, you know, I think, you know, there's my Kev Colbert, obviously was, I think, there for the 1 year. And, you know, could you see Gronkowski circle back around if this is Richard Mann's final season?
I'm trying. Wasn't he with the Falcons for a little while?
Yeah, I want to say 2013. He was their quarterback's coach, I want to say. He's been around a little bit. 2011, their quarterback's coach for the Falcons.
Yeah, he's been, if memory serves me, he's been kind of all over the place. Wow, I mean, I'd rather have how I mean, this is still going to be a relatively, outside of AB, this is going to be a relatively young unit heading into next, you know, into 2018, right?
I guess in age, but they have experience. It'll be an experienced group, least you expect it to.
I'd much rather have an older, more experienced coach, obviously coming off of Richard Mann. You know, and
well, Gronkowski's an older guy. He's going to be 62
right,
by the end of this year.
And that's what I'm getting at.
Or you're agreeing with me. I thought you were disagreeing.
Right,
okay.
No, I'd much rather have an older, more experienced guy. For only one name being thrown out there, it's hard to shoot it down. You know, so
We don't have to get too in the weeds in this. I just wanted to throw his name out there because I love Hines Ward as much as anybody, but you can't always go from playing in the NFL to coaching in the NFL immediately. The job requirements are two totally separate things, and just because you played well does not mean you can coach well. So it's just, we got to pump the brakes on that a little bit, Steelers Nation.
Okay, now the best part of this show, probably the Twitter listener questions here, and we'll start. I've got two of them from Elijah Brown. Looks like at Elijah Genesis on Twitter. Is it just me, or does it feel like Sean Davis almost played so solid towards the end of the season that we don't talk about his progression? And I'll start this one off. I think we were talking, and I think we've talked about, or at least you and I have talked about Sean Davis and the progression that he made during the second half of the season there. So I don't think he's being slighted for his development. I mean, look, the first half of the season, not only was he injured, but having to learn the defense and then play some in the slot. But I mean, he made some big plays, I thought, during the second half of the season. And of course, he went on to be named, the Steelers' rookie of the year. Even though you probably could have made arguments for Artie Burns and Javon Hargrave to win the award as well, too. So, I guess Elijah, if you're asking, do we feel like he's being slighted, by the media, by us, by other Steelers fans? I don't feel that way.
I think he did get some credit, and I think he deserves more credit the more we find out about his injuries last year. It's like a hockey player at the end of the Stanley Cup Finals. You get to learn about the injury history and look back and go, wow, I can't believe he played through all that. And, Davis played through the back injury, obviously the torn labrum in his shoulder. He improved as the year went on. That's what Carnell Lake said, and that's what stuck out the most to me, is that despite all that adversity, and he dealt with a lot last year, to continue to make the strides you would expect any normal, healthy rookie to make, I think is impressive. And that has me really excited for Sean Davis taking a big, significant jump in year two, more so than what you would normally expect a rookie to make, because he's going to be healthy. He's going to be playing strong safety from the get-go. There's not going to be a question about where he's going to line up. He's not going to get bounced around. All those things are huge for Sean Davis, so I am excited. The big thing with him, making more splash plays, so that strong safety spot, that Troy held for so many years, big splash plays. That secondary is not getting enough, and Davis has to be that guy.
I think one of the other things as well, too, with him, and look, this goes back to his college days, missed tackles. Now, he is around the football a lot and was in college, but he had quite a few missed tackles, and, he missed some tackles last year on top of him. So you'd like to see him shore up that tackling a little bit and kind of playing into that. I think we talked about this a couple, two or three shows ago. When he does come off the edge, I think I can count at least two times in off the top of my head that he missed sacks that he should have had.
And, you're right. But when you got a bad back and a bad shoulder, it can be tough to finish.
Sure,
if you're hurting.
Sure, absolutely. So, if there were two areas, obviously the playmaking, as you state, the other two areas, as I indicated, the tackling and being able to finish and get home when you do come off the edge as a blitzer, I'd like to see him improve on. But Elijah, I personally don't think he's being slighted, and I think there's really right now a lot of optimism surrounding Sean Davis. Elijah's second question was, has your opinion on Joshua Dobbs changed at all as far as whether or not he's capable of one day taking over for the Steelers as the starter? And look, I have watched a lot of Tennessee tape on Joshua Dobbs, especially during that dead zone ahead of OTAs and all like that. And while I became a lot more comfortable with the abilities of Joshua Dobbs, based on that, more so than I came out of the draft, I'm still not ready. I'm not there saying no. I'm not comfortable or think that there, or think there's a good chance that him taking over as a starter one day. There's just not enough there. We got to see him change a lot of things, in my opinion, based on his NFL play. And look, we're going to get a long look at him during the preseason, but not much more after that. So it's probably going to be well into the 2018 preseason before we probably get an idea of hey, can this guy potentially take over eventually down the line?
I never want to rule anything out, and I understand I've been sour on Dobbs, and I don't want to keep ragging on the guy forever and ever, but, his path is just so tough. I mean, it's tough for any, fourth-round quarterback. The number of those guys that have gone on to become starters, it's a pretty short list. Kirk Cousins, Russell Wilson in the third, and, Tom Brady. I've said it before. The thing with Dobbs is that the Steelers are very likely to take a quarterback high in this upcoming draft or the one after that, you know, as their true heir to Big Ben. I don't think they're going to envision Dobbs as that guy, or at the very least, they're not going to put all their eggs in that basket. So, you know, you think about it, in another year or two at most, you're going to have a first or second round pick sitting there, and that's going to be tough for Dobbs to ever get that kind of play time. So I think it's just going to be tough for Dobbs to ever really get that opportunity. I think his ceiling is a, you know, in this situation, maybe somewhere else he could have been more successful, because I think he's got some talent, but I think in this situation, his ceiling is a slightly better version of Landry Jones.
Okay, thank you, Elijah, for your questions. Jose Ortiz, at Ortiz underscore, it looks like. Do you think Keon Adams will be on the 53-man roster, and Cooper as well, too? Man, I really am rooting for Keon Adams. I mean, I've said it several times. I think it's going to come down to a battle between him and Arthur Motes. And if Keon Adams can show any upside on special teams, I like his chances. You know, if you want to push me for an answer right now, I'll say, yeah, Keon Adams will be on the 53 this year. But, of course, you know, haven't seen him play a lick of special teams right now. I'm pretty much all I'm basing that prediction on is what Arthur Motes is right now. So, you know, kind of a round the corner kind of way of looking at it. As far as Ethan Cooper, I think a lot of injuries have to happen for Cooper to make this roster. I really like Cooper as a practice squad guy, though. But, no, I do not think Ethan Cooper will make the 53. And, once again, I think Adams is firmly tied to what happens with Arthur Motes.
I 100% agree, Dave. The only thing I would say is that it might not take a ton of injuries for Cooper. One injury to a Finney or a Hubbard or a Foster, you know, that could get him on the roster.
Okay, thanks for the question, Jose. Christian Perry at I can't even read. Sorry, I'm not going to be able to get your username out there because I can't read it. I don't have my glasses on. He asked if you could trade draft picks with any other team, who would you choose? I'm not sure I understand the gist of that question.
Is that future draft picks or this past draft? Or
maybe.
If it's future picks, give me the Jets picks because I know where they're going to be at the end of this year.
Yeah, I'm assuming he's saying this past year. You know, that just happened. Boy, I'd have to go back and look. I don't know. The Ravens, right?
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
The Ravens or the Bengals, right? Because if you look at the Ravens, let's pull up their draft picks real quick.
I mean, they got Bowser. You know, they got a couple edge guys that I liked. I'm looking for the Cardinals too, because I might go with Arizona. I have to look.
Let's see here.
I like Marlon Humphrey. You know, that would have been a good upside corner pick.
Let's see. Do you have them all in front of you there?
I was picking up Arizona's. I was just off the top of my head going with Baltimore. Humphrey in the first. They get Bowser later on.
Here you go. Humphrey, of course, in the first round. Bowser, Wormley, who the Steelers supposedly had some sort of interest in. Tim Williams, you know, out of Alabama. I don't know much about Nico Siragusa out of San Diego State. Did you watch much or any of him?
He's a big power, you know, mauler in the run game as a guard for them.
Jermaine Elamunor, I don't know anything about him out of Texas A&M.
Like a developmental tackle.
And then Chuck Clark, a cornerback out of Virginia Tech. I don't remember watching any film on him either.
And Bowser. You mentioned Bowser.
Yeah, I mentioned Bowser, and I know you were very, very high on him. Let's see, the Bengals. I'm probably going to end up going with the Bengals one right here. Let's see. John Ross, of course, first round. Joe Mixon, I could do without Joe Mixon in Pittsburgh. Jordan Willis, obviously. Carl Lawson, you know, a guy that, you know, I know you were when the dust finally cleared, I was still high on Lawson. I just wasn't considering him a first or second round draft pick with him, but I mean the reports on him so far out of their training camp with Carl Lawson have been very glowing. Josh Malone, I'm kind of mad on, but and it's partly because of watching a lot of Joshua Dobbs film. there are a lot of times where he didn't help Joshua Dobbs out, in my opinion. But for a fourth round receiver, okay. Ryan Glasgow, defensive tackle out of Michigan. Jake Elliott, kicker out of Memphis. The Steelers obviously didn't need a kicker. The Bengals did. J.J. Delman, a developmental tackle out of Utah. Jordan Evans, an inside linebacker out of Oklahoma. I don't know. That'd be nice to play with about right now, I think. Brandon Wilson, a guy that he ended up suffering an injury, I think. 5'10 cornerback out of Houston. Probably wouldn't have been bad. Then Mason Schreck, a tight end out of Buffalo, was their last pick. So I don't know. I think it'd be maybe a toss up between the Ravens and the Bengals, right?
I'm gonna go with Arizona. I pull up their class. Hassan Reddick at 13. We knew what he could do as an athlete, inside outside kind of guy. So you would have liked Reddick, if he would have fallen hypothetically, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right, Dave?
Yeah,
Reddick. Buda Baker.
I liked him a lot more as an inside guy, potential.
Right, yeah, fair enough. Buda Baker in the second round, who, would end up being that probably slot corner for Pittsburgh. So that would have solved that, undersized, but a real big hitter. Chad Williams in the third, who I think the Steelers did like. I'm surprised Williams went in the third, but, are one of the better vertical threats in this entire draft class that had a nice Senior Bowl week. You get into some offensive linemen in the fourth, Dorian Johnson from Pitt, Will Holden from Vanderbilt, TJ Logan in the fifth, kind of a scat back, and then Rudy Ford in the sixth, who I liked as a sleeper safety. So, but those first couple picks of Reddick, Baker, and Williams, I'd have been very happy with that.
Yeah, I watched a little bit of Ford as well, too. I think I had him in one of my early mock drafts, did I not?
I think you did.
A guy that probably going to be a special teams, maybe practice squad guy to start with, but had a little bit of upside to him there. So fair enough there. And Christian, I hope you were meaning trade draft picks from this year. I'm assuming you were. Thanks for the question. AJ AJ writes, if Sutton would start on defense this season, do you think Butler would have to simplify like last year? Look, if there's one guy that you probably don't have to simplify the defense for, it's Cameron Sutton. I mean, we heard Bob Shoup talk about how smart he was. We now heard kind of how the conversations went when Kevin Colbert and Mike Tomlin went to Tennessee to visit with Sutton and made him put on the film and stuff like that. So no, I don't. Obviously there's still going to be some adjustments, the terminology, a little bit of scheme differences and all like that. But I don't foresee Keith Butler having to, simplify the defense for a guy like Sutton. And at this point right now, he wouldn't anyway, I don't think. You kind of go with the guys, that you have, which obviously a lot of second-year guys are going to be part of that defense. But in short, I said this about Duran Grant, though, too, coming out of Ohio State. He was perceived as a very smart, football IQ guy, but, that resulted in him being gone almost as quickly as he got here. So would you agree with me?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that he was viewed as one of the smartest, defensive backs coming out of the draft. And I go back again, I'll just tell the quick story at the Senior Bowl as they moved him to safety and really had never played safety before. And he did it well. And they played slot corner, he played on the outside. I mean, he's at the Senior Bowl where he's already in a new environment, new coaching staff, new teammates, new NFL playbook, different terminology. He's playing new spots. And he picked it up like it was nothing. And that's as impressive and as much of a compliment as you can ever give to a guy.
All right. Thank you, AJ, for the question. And we'll end it with one more here from Yens Already Know on Twitter. The PHAWKS89 on Twitter here. He writes, what has to happen for Martavis Bryant to get a long-term deal with the Steelers? Outside of a minor miracle, and has a little bit better chance than a minor miracle, I should add, but he's going to have to A, keep his nose clean from here on out. He's going to have to become a little bit more well-rounded receiver, in my opinion, Alex. I mean, we all know what he can do deep with stretching the field and what he can do, you know, on kind of the screen, you know, passes and all like that. He, you know, in my opinion, for the type of money that he perceives to possibly make, you know, come time to re-sign him, to the type of game that he plays, to the Steelers' history in the past when dealing with guys like Plaxico and kind of deep threat to Mike Wallace and those type of, you know, guys, I think he really has to become a much more well-rounded receiver, and then keep your fingers crossed even then.
Yeah, I don't know if it's about being well-rounded. I think there's no – I don't think the talent is an issue at all. I don't think about the way he plays the game is an issue at all. I think it's all about just the off the field, and do you trust this guy long-term? And that's what he's going to have to show over the next 2 years, is that he can be trusted. He is truly a changed guy. He's changed his lifestyle, you know, 180 degrees. That's going to be what he has to do, I think, plain and simple.
And we've seen in the past, like I said, Plaxico. I mean, they, you know, there comes a time where you can't sign everybody, you know, as much as you'd probably like to. But if things go like I think and hope they will with Martavis Bryant, he's going to have a nice rebound 2017 season, another great season 2018 and all. And I just think come time for him to potentially be a unrestricted free agent candidate. I just think his market price is going to be well out of reach of what the Steelers want to pay him. And I as we sit here right now, I will be surprised if he sees a second contract with the Steelers.
Yeah, I'm a little more optimistic than you. I know we've had that debate before, so we'll see what happens.
All right, we're at the end here. Anything else you'd like to wrap up with before we get out of here for a little bit over a week?
Just real quick, I'm about to retweet, and I haven't read it yet, it just popped up on my timeline, an article from Alex Marvez from Sporting News about Isaiah Pede. It looks really good, the picture and the headline. You know, Pede was a Steeler for a short time, so I encourage you guys to check that one out.
All right, Alex, I appreciate you sitting in for David Todd once again, and appreciate you helping me fill this hour up with the talk not centered around Le'Veon Bell's contract and Alejandro Villanueva. So thankfully, we avoided those topics today. Folks, as I said, once again, no podcast on Friday this week, no podcast next Monday. We'll be back a week from Friday with a show. You can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. You can follow David Todd on Twitter at David M. Todd. Follow Alex Cazora at Alex_Cazora. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. You can email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. And if you like what we do and want to donate to the cause, go to SteelersDepot.com, find that donate button, upper right navigational bar. And as always, thanks for listening to The Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.